We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hey everyone, welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have a return guest today. He was a popular character in season one of Perpetual Chess. He's gotten even more popular. He's got 41,000 YouTube subscribers somehow. I looked away for a minute and his channel exploded. He's well known recently for beating Magnus Carlsen, both accidentally and on purpose online. He's an international master, also a photographer, a Twitter master, and a reporter. I am Eric Rosen. Thanks for coming back to Perpetual Chess.
It's great to be back, Ben. Thanks for having me yet again.
Yeah, and you're in St. Louis. You said, I know you had a tournament a couple of weeks ago, but what made you stick around?
Well, I actually moved here. I've been living here since the beginning of April, like right after US Championships. I spent kind of the last 2 years living very nomadically, and I decided I'd want a home base, and I have so many friends in St. Louis, and the chess culture is so great here. So it was funny how I got a place here, because on April 1st, I posted on Twitter, also made a YouTube post, that I would be moving into the Chess Bra apartment in St. Louis. And everyone thought it was April Fool's.
Yeah, but I was going to say, I know where this story is going, but keep going.
But yeah, it's actually true. Like Eric Hansen has a place here, and it's a two-bedroom apartment, had an extra bedroom, amazing location, very affordable. And yeah, it's been great so far.
That's funny, because even so, I remembered that tweet. So I went back to look at it in preparation for this interview, and seeing it was April 1st and it was passed and reading through the comments, I couldn't figure out if it's real or not. And I decided going down an April Fool's rabbit hole wouldn't be the best use of our interview time. But now the mystery is solved. So how are you liking living in St. Louis?
It's great. I mean, especially living in the Central West End, I'm walking distance from the chess club. It's been very nice so far. There's shops and restaurants and Whole Foods nearby, and I've really, really enjoyed it so far.
And it must have been a nice feeling. So you just played recently in the
St. Louis Norm Congress.
Thank you. It was in this outline somewhere. I know that they often involve the seasons, but this one didn't, the titles of the tournament. But anyway, it must have been a nice feeling playing in that tournament and just being able to walk over and play your games.
That's true. Yeah, it was very convenient. I mean, just 10-minute walk to get to the chess club. I will say though that I had kind of had this goal not to play much competitive chess since like getting back from my extended international trip. And then about a month before the tournament, I was invited, and the conditions at the St. Louis Chess Club are just always so amazing, and like the finest details are paid attention to. So it was a difficult invitation to turn down. And yeah, overall, it was nice to get back and play some competitive chess.
Yeah, and it looked like you did pretty reasonably. How did you feel? What was your evaluation of how it went for you?
Yeah, I think in the first few rounds, I had some very messy games. Like my first game, I was white, and I blundered on move 13, and I thought I was just going to lose like really quickly. But somehow I was able to like regroup myself during the game. And after I blundered, I spent like 35 minutes digging for any sort of like possibility to come back. And I found what I think in hindsight was the strongest continuation. I fought on and almost won the game, ended in a draw as my game against Aaron Jacobson. And then after that game, I played Rochelle Wu, and she was completely crushing me. I think the computer said like plus 8 for her. Yikes. And somehow I drew that. And then like in the last round of the tournament, I was very close to tying for first. If I won my last round, I would have tied for first. So I was able to rebound, but final round game was a draw. So I finished in, I think, a tie for third. So can't be too disappointed with the overall result.
Yeah, and outperformed your FIDE rating a little bit, as I recall.
That's true. And actually, another thing I did differently for this tournament, which I've never done before, was I recorded every single like preparation session for each opponent. And I also streamed every game review. I was a bit inspired by Nakamura because he at least streamed his game reviews during US Championships, and he had a very good result. So I was kind of doing extra work between rounds to produce some content for the online audience.
And that's how you get 41,000 YouTube subscribers, ladies and gentlemen. No, yeah.
Well, that's how I try and keep it up.
Right. Yeah, no, I was just catching up on your channel, and I caught one of the one of the preparation videos, and I really liked the idea. I hadn't, to my knowledge, I hadn't seen anything like that done. And of course, it's a nice way to learn an opening. And to, I know in our previous interview, you mentioned the importance of knowing one's way around chess base. So it was a nice way to see like sort of how a strong player prepares.
Sure. Yeah, I was actually a bit hesitant in like deciding to record and post those because they're not the standard sort of instructive videos where I'm explaining like simple concepts to beginners, which is a large portion of people who watch chess videos on YouTube. And then I was also, of course, hesitant because I'm sharing secrets and I'm sharing prep that I might want to use in the future. But I'm at a point right now where I'm focusing way more on like just education and also just experimentation, trying to find new ways of content and share kind of the ins and outs of trying to play high level chess.
Yeah, so you kind of have to throw it out there and then see if it resonates and you know do more of what works and less of what doesn't. So
exactly. Yeah.
So how did you feel like it landed with your subscriber base? Where was the feedback mostly good? Or I mean, like, and do you look more at the comments when you evaluate something like that, or do you look more at the impressions and views and all that stuff?
Yeah, that's a good question. I look at both, of course. Feedback has been very positive, and like sometimes this is one of the challenges with YouTube because especially YouTube comments have a reputation of sometimes being toxic and
yes,
there can be trolls. But from what I've seen, at least across like the chess community and in my videos, I mean, it's a lot of positive feedback, but there's also some criticism, and I try and, I read a lot of the comments and try and incorporate whatever like requests people have. And for these videos specifically, I found the preparation sessions get far less viewership than other videos I do. I think just because they're targeted to like just higher level audience. I would imagine the intended rating range for someone watching those types of videos is at least 1800. But the game review videos get a lot more exposure and viewership.
Yeah, I actually filtered your videos for most popular, so I have kind of my own conclusion about this. But what's your general conclusion about what seems to resonate the most?
Yeah, that's also an interesting question. Sometimes it just depends on the YouTube algorithm, like what exactly people are paying attention to and commenting on and watching all the way through. I have realized like certain patterns with videos, like any videos that mention like tricky openings,
yeah,
or opening traps,
yeah,
or even like, okay, Magnus Carlsen, like there's certain keywords that I think are very much able to boost the kind of the visibility of a video.
Yeah, the openings generally and opening traps in particular was what I noticed as well. And of course, on this podcast, me and some other guests are constantly harping on, like preaching not to overemphasize openings. So I'm thinking it might be a slightly different audience between this podcast and the you know, legions of people tuning into your videos.
Yeah, I mean, there's a good number of people out there who are interested in chess, and like when you're first beginning chess, sometimes learning the first few moves of an opening is easiest and most interesting to pursue. So,
yeah, I mean, it sort of gives you a map at least.
Exactly. Yeah, and there is one video I have. It was actually my first, like the first ever live stream I did on Twitch. I ended up posting to YouTube, and it was called something like Beating People with Tricky Openings. And when I streamed it on Twitch, there were maybe 1 to 3 viewers because my channel is brand new. But now the video on YouTube has like 250,000 views. So it's pretty crazy how those things can take off.
Yeah, the numbers just astound me because, you know, this podcast gets about like 3,500 downloads an episode or something like that, which I'm happy with. I have no complaints. I enjoy it, and I, you know, I'm happy that it resonates with enough people to allow me to keep doing it. But then I see the YouTube numbers, and I think about like I'm having trouble keeping up with emails and stuff like that, and I didn't like listener emails, and I didn't used to have that problem. So when the numbers are like almost tenfold what the audience is for the podcast, to me it's just like, wow, how do you even function?
Yeah, it's it can be tough. And I mean, especially these days, messages can come in from, I mean, just a myriad of platforms between email and social media, YouTube comments, and like the chess platforms like LeeChess and chess.com. So it's hard to balance, and sometimes you just have to filter through messages. And I'm working on like an FAQ section on my website where I'll at least be able to direct people to like the most commonly asked questions.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. Well, in a less commonly asked question, Eric, I did want to circle back to you mentioning you having made a conscious decision to de-emphasize tournament chess before you couldn't resist the offer from the St. Louis Chess Club. So what made you take that decision?
I think it's been a combination of things. It's not to say that I will not be, I'm retiring or anything. I felt a little burnt out. I played, I took like a very long international trip from November through February this most recent year. And I played these back-to-back tournaments in Australia, where it was basically 18 days in a row of chess with no rest day. And I found that it was just hard to be productive like during a tournament, as the games go along, and then you spend time preparing for the next round, and to keep up kind of my online brand and business, it's not easy during a competition. And also I've I know, like, for me, I'm an international master. The obvious next step is to get the Grandmaster title. But I've made the decision that I want to pursue more education, more of the online brand and online projects, rather than taking chess like so professionally in terms of playing. But I will be playing in a couple months in Montreal. There's an invitational tournament there. I'm still very much trying to use chess as a vehicle for travel. So
cool. Yeah. Have you been to Montreal?
I've not. I've actually never been to Canada. So really looking forward to it. And especially in the summertime, it should be nice.
Yeah. I haven't been there in the summer, but people say it's like life altering in the summer. I was there in like the dreary winter, and it's a really cool city even then. So,
I was invited to play there in January. It was the same time I think I was in probably like Thailand or Indonesia. And there is no way I was going to Canada in January, especially from like Southeast Asia.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be a bad move.
Yeah.
So are your landlords running this tournament, the Chess Bras?
So it's actually Lefong Hua, who he's a FIDE master. I don't think he's considered like formally a chess bra, but he's definitely within.
I've seen him in their videos, though. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's been around probably in some of the older videos that they've done. But I think he's organized this tournament for the last year or two. And it's intended for a lot of talented like Canadian junior players. So feel like there's going to be a target on my back being kind of one of the IMs, and it's an IM Norm Invitational. So, yeah, we'll see how it goes.
Cool. Do you think you're going to keep going with recording your preparation?
I think I'll try. Yeah. Especially if I know the pairings like well beforehand, then I'll just try and record preparation sessions before the tournament. And that way I'll hold myself accountable too. That's another thing that I think doing the sort of content provides in terms of the strength is accountability. So hoping to do that, but we'll see.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, I encourage you to keep it up. I found it pretty interesting, and yeah, give it at least, it's one more tournament, see how it resonates with people and take it from there. But yeah, I mean, as I said, I hadn't seen anything like it. So, and I'm sure as time goes on, people will, when they search whatever individual opening, you know, if yours is named in the headline, they'll likely find it and learn from it.
That's true. The only thing though is I have to, if I record my prep sessions, I have to post it after the game,
yeah,
and not before the game.
Yeah,
and I won't be live streaming any of the prep sessions.
Yeah, that would be a little too trusting.
Yes. Yeah.
So we have a couple questions related to YouTube content because obviously this is a subject that you know a decent bit about. So. The first one is from supporter of the podcast, Bradley Dupree, who asks, the chess instruction and content on YouTube, including your videos, are entertaining, educational, and high quality. Given the amount of great content, do you have any YouTube video recommendations or strategies or themes to filter to specific content that would be most helpful for an adult improver in the 1300 to 1500 range?
Yeah, that's a tough question. The problem with YouTube is there's so many videos out there. So filtering is actually, a key strategy in finding what you're looking for. I would say that it's probably the first step is to identify what channels you like the best or what sort of content creators or lecturers you resonate the most with. And everyone's different in this regard. So I think it's important to explore, like check out different channels, see what sort of content creators are resonating well with your learning style. One channel I can recommend is St. Louis Chess Club, who, I mean, they just have, I think over 1,000 videos of so many different lectures who've been coming to the club over the years. And then once you find a channel, I would recommend using the filter within the channel. Like anytime you're viewing a channel on YouTube, you can search for keywords in that channel. And then it's a matter of searching what you want to learn. Like if you go to my channel and you type in London opening, you'll you'll have at least like 10 videos to learn from. And the same applies to any other channel. For the 1300 to 1500 range, another YouTuber that comes to mind, and actually one YouTuber who I've been very inspired from, is John Bartholomew.
Yeah.
Who I know who's also been on the podcast. And I think his content is very instructive, especially for that that rating range.
Yeah, I was going to mention his Climbing the Rating Ladder and Climbing the Tactics Ladder series. Is like, he's got huge archives online, and if you search for those, like, I mean, when he's doing, you know, 2500 level tactics, it can be, I would imagine, hard to keep up. I mean, it's hard for me to keep up. But when he's going through and you see the lower rated stuff, it's sort of like right at the edge of your comprehension. So yeah, that might be a good avenue to explore. And I, like you, am a huge fan of the stuff he puts out.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I mean, he has also like a very large archive of just like blitz games he plays, and he mentions the opening in every single game that he plays, at least in his previous videos. So you could just like go to his channel, type in the name of an opening you want to learn, and see his commentary in those specific games.
Cool. Well, hopefully, Bradley, that is helpful. And I've got one more YouTube related question. This one, I have a feeling there might be like some inside joke I'm not totally privy to. Okay. But wouldn't be the first time. So it's from Aaron Wafflart. Thank you for the support, Aaron. And he says, "Hey, Ben and Eric, thanks for the YouTube videos, Eric. I've added the London Fog to my drinks repertoire at the end of last year. Do you have any unusual drink recommendations for a drinker under the 1400 rating level? Thanks. P.S. I tried the Scotch, but I always lose focus out of the opening." So I think I get that one, at least. I think I get the end of it.
I mean, yeah, the Scotch is a very playable opening, but in terms of a drink during a chess game, I think it's slightly dubious.
Yeah, been there and done that.
Yeah.
It's enjoyable, but yeah, maybe not the highest quality chess. I don't know what the London Fog is. Are you familiar, Eric?
Oh, of course. Yeah, it's I think I've mentioned on my stream before. It's probably one of my favorite drinks to get at Starbucks.
Ah, and okay. It's not even alcohol.
No, it's not alcohol. It's not even on the Starbucks menu, but essentially it's a tea latte. So it's a latte made with, like, I think Earl Grey tea or some kind of black tea. And it's really good. Like, not, it's a little bit sweet, but very calming, and it's not a bad drink to accompany you during a chess game. It shares a name with my favorite opening too, so it's just another reason to like it.
Yeah. And in terms of if you were going to actually be I'm not sure what Aaron's getting at. I mean, I think he's mostly having fun here, but if you're going to be drinking something during a game, obviously caffeine is performance enhancing. I would say alcohol is performance debilitating for the most part. But I would, my personal guess and experience is that wine is probably the least destructive. I've sat in beer gardens on sunny days and played Blitz with Mike Klein in Prague. That was a fun day. The Blitz got worse and worse for sure. but with wine, I feel like it hits you a little slower. So I think that's the official perpetual chess recommendation for.
Yeah, Ben, I think you might have way more experience when it comes
to
drinks.
Yeah, I remember you saying you're not a big drinker, so.
No. But he is asking for unusual drink recommendations. So there is another one that comes to mind, which, like, there's only one place in the world that you can get it. And I've actually had it. There's this cafe restaurant in Sydney, Australia, and it's called Queenside. Not sure if you've heard of it. But it's a chess themed.
Oh, the one with that names stuff after chess personalities?
Like, exactly.
Yeah. Yes.
So they have a mocktail named after me called The Rosen. And I actually went there in December, and I tried my own drink. The owner actually opened the restaurant like during the holiday week so I could visit and try it. And it is a very unusual drink. It has like rose petals and rose water and yuzu lemons and soda water, but it was really good, very refreshing.
Did you talk to them at all about how they decide they're going to name a drink after you? And then Oh, I guess the rose theme is what they went with.
I think, yeah, the rose, so rose water and rose petals, I guess, is somehow related to my last name.
Okay, cool. Yeah, well, obviously, if I ever make it back to Australia, I'm gonna stop.
Yeah, if you're
by.
A chess player in Australia, you should at least try as Queenside in Sydney at least once.
Yeah, you got to support the chess, the places that promote chess like that. All right, Eric, I have one or two more content creation questions for you. I've been waiting for a guest who does some Twitch streaming. Somehow I haven't had as many as you would think because, mm-hmm. I mean, as regular listeners might have heard me say, I mean, a good part of the reason this podcast exists is because I felt kind of left out of the online chess community because I'm basically never at my computer anymore, even though when I was younger, I was at my computer all the time and would have been watching chess content all the time. But now I'm mostly running around and chasing my children and working and all that. So I barely understand Twitch. I've probably watched a few hours total of it in my life. And just in case there's anyone even less educated than I am, I guess we should first define that Twitch is basically the medium for live streaming. Whereas YouTube is more for, you can live stream on YouTube, but it's more commonly associated with archived videos. And Twitch also archives the videos, but it's more commonly associated with live streaming. But there's a couple basic terms regarding Twitch that I'm not crystal clear on what they mean. So what does it mean to gift a sub?
Gift a sub. Okay. So yeah, you're exactly right. There's all this like terminology that if you're not familiar with the platform or the community, it can be confusing at first. So on Twitch, there's basically different ways to support streamers. And one of them is by subscribing to the streamer. And to subscribe to a streamer, you can either do it through Amazon Prime. You can subscribe, I think, to one streamer for free every month. Or you, the standard way is to pay $5 every month. And it has a similar model to Patreon, where you pay some monthly amount and you support the content creator. To gift a sub is to basically pay for another user's subscription. So it's a very like generous action when you just you give another user kind of this status showing that they're supporting a streamer. And subscribers on Twitch sometimes can get like special privileges or access. I mean, the big thing is anyone who subscribes to my channel has access to all of my custom emotes. So all these like little symbol things, which I have a whole set of them kind of designed around my brand. Another thing that a lot of streamers do, including myself, is they have streams kind of designated for subscribers. So anyone who has been gifted a sub or who subscribes on their own will have the chance or will have a better chance to play me in some of these like subscriber streams. So it's a way to get more involved and to support us chess streamers or any streamer to continue creating content.
So that's helpful. And that was basically my supposition, but who gets it? How do you decide who gets the subs that are gifted if they go to another person?
Oh, so there's actually a couple different ways you can gift a sub on Twitch. So one way is just to basically select the user, say that I want to give the user a subscription to whatever channel. And usually you do it while the streamer is live.
Okay.
On most streams, if someone subscribes during a live stream, it will pop up on stream that so-and-so has subscribed and the streamer will give a shout out to whoever that is. Another way to do it is what's called, I forget the exact term, it's either like sub bombs or like community subs, where you gift like between 5 to 100 random users, subscribers to a channel.
That was my next question, yeah. So it's random, okay.
So it's random when you gift like these sub bombs. And that, of course, can be a lot more costly, but I mean, it's really cool when it happens because whoever's gifting like so many subs, I mean, gets a lot of love, is an ongoing chat. So I think it makes the community better, and it's a very nice way to kind of grow the community and get more people engaged.
Yeah, and it would be significant revenue for the streamer, right?
That's true. So I should mention, unlike Patreon, Twitch does take, I think, a larger percentage of the like the revenue. So I think it's split 50-50. So every sub is closer to like $2.50 for a streamer.
Yeah, $2.50 per month.
But still nice support.
Yeah, no, I mean, and probably, honestly, I mean, probably it ends up being more remunerative than a lot of Patreon content creators would get.
For sure.
And listeners, I'm sorry if I sound like just like a terribly out of touch old man, but I have to tell you, this is how I feel whenever I turn on Twitch. I'm just like, what does this mean? And it can be hard to figure out. So, last one. And again, I think I know, but I want to make sure I'm not missing something. What is raiding?
So this is another thing unique to live streaming, because on YouTube, you can watch whenever you want, but on Twitch, when someone's doing a live stream, everyone's watching live. So when they end the stream, there could be a large group of people who might not be sure what to watch next. So a raid is when you end your stream and then you send all of the people who were concurrently watching your stream to another channel who is live streaming.
Okay. That was what I thought. Yeah.
Yeah. So for example, I was streaming the other day, and it was around the same time that Nakamura was streaming. And Nakamura ended his stream. There were maybe 1,000 to 1,500 people watching his stream. And he raided me. So wow. Within the span of a few seconds, I got 1,000 more viewers watching me at the same time. So it was slightly frightening, but it was really cool.
Yeah, he seems to really be enjoying streaming on Twitch.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And he's grown immensely over the last 6 months to a year since he started. So that's great to see.
Yeah, it's definitely good for chess. And obviously, you can learn a thing or two watching him play chess.
For sure.
So in terms of, when we talked last, I believe it was late 2017, mid to late 2017. I think it was August. You had finished up college, but you were kind of plotting your next move. You were trying to decide am I going to get some sort of full-time job or lead the life of a digital nomad, which obviously would involve a lot of, the chess stuff that you're doing. So, and we were talking just for a second, off air before we started recording, and you were saying how it was funny to sit back and listen to that. So mm-hmm. how have things, let me try to phrase this correctly. How has the way your professional career is shaping up so far conformed to your expectations back then?
Sure. I mean, a lot has changed over the last couple of years. And I was listening to my first interview on Perpetual Chess last night. And I think it was done, I looked up the exact date. It was done August 11th, 2017. So approaching 2 years ago. And at that time, I had mentioned that I was getting really interested in like researching the digital nomad lifestyle. And that was like essentially around the beginning where I started traveling just a ton. And for 2 years, I lived pretty nomadically, like taking a handful of Europe trips and then Australia and Southeast Asia. Like the last two winters, I've been taking advantage of the warmer weather on the other side of the world. And during that time, I mean, I've been doing a lot of different sort of chess-related jobs. And that's spanned from, private coaching, online, some freelance like photography, web design, web development, and then also growing my brand online. And I don't think we even talked about Twitch or YouTube in our last interview because I wasn't even on my radar. But yeah, I started Twitch, like started doing content for Twitch and YouTube in, I think, the winter of 2017. And that's been a big part of not only like just my enjoyment, but also just another revenue stream too. So sometimes it's hard to tell people what I do for a living, because there's probably at least 5 to 6 like main revenue sources. But I mean, recently it's been sustainable and it's been growing. So I'm very grateful to be where I am, where I can, you know, do what I love for work.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's well deserved. I mean, you have a good communication style. You're a good teacher, and you're down to earth. So I am, other than the fact that I'm a dinosaur who doesn't understand Twitch, I'm not surprised.
Well, I think there's a lot of people like you, so it's good that you're providing the platform to help other people who are maybe less familiar with this sort of medium.
Yeah.
But, yeah. But thanks for the words.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I feel like I'm one step removed from understanding it. But then of course there's the older generation where, like, you know, I was listening to, David Letterman was on the Mark Maron podcast recently. And you know, Mark Maron is one of my favorite interviewers. And, whenever there's an interesting guest, I try to tune in, and obviously Letterman's a comedy legend. But David Letterman, like, half the time was like, what's a podcast? How do you listen to a podcast? You know,
That's great.
And obviously there's a whole generation of people who it's becoming less and less, common as more people discover them, but there's still people out there. I mean, it's such a weird word, and it has its own vocabulary too, although probably not to the extent that Twitch does. So yeah, every once in a while, we just have to make sure everyone's, on the same page.
Sure. I mean, it's hard to keep up these days because, especially like the media landscape is continually evolving. Maybe a couple years ago, Twitch was a very, very maybe strange platform to provide chess content on, because it's more geared towards video games. But this is a case for just so many like social media platforms, and sometimes you just have to like seek out where the attention is, and then pursue the platforms where people are giving their attention.
Yeah, chess.com seems to be devoting a lot of resources to like outreach through Twitch.
Oh, definitely, with good reason. I mean, their partnership has been it's been amazing for the overall community for last couple of years, and they've done, I mean, just so many events, and they've gotten so much exposure, especially using the resources that Twitch has. So. I feel like this is just the beginning. So it'll be cool to see where this goes over the next few years.
Yeah, it will be interesting. Do you think that Twitch alone, like, would that have the potential to just be your one and only gig if it continued to grow?
Well, I wouldn't want it to, like, I wouldn't want any one thing to be like my one like gig or source of revenue. I think it's good to have variety. But it's definitely something that I intend to like pursue further and try and keep growing. Cause I mean, so far it's just, it's been a steady uphill trend, and yeah, it seems like the overall platform is growing, and the chess community within the platform is also growing.
Cool. Sounds like a good place to be. Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's talk some chess improvement, Eric. So the first time we had you on, I did re-listen, so I reheard your one book recommendation and reheard you say you're not a big book person. But
oh man, I'm trying to remember what the book recommendation was. I didn't get to the point at that point in the interview.
Okay.
Was it Imagination and Chess,
yep.
Right?
Which okay. Was echoed subsequently by none other than GM Jakub Agard. So you're
I listened to that one.
Yeah, you're in heady company.
I remember, I think even like when you interviewed him, you mentioned my name in relation to that book. So
I remembered. Yeah. Because, that was the only person. I mean, it's rare by this point that someone recommends a book that I had not heard of. So that's why I remembered that one. And yeah, I need to get my hands on that book. Re-listening to you talk about it made me even more eager to do so. And as I recall, even though it's out of print, it's not like one of those insanely expensive out of print chess books.
Right.
So anyway, we're not going to ask you for book recommendations, but since you are working with your students fairly frequently, one thing I thought you might be able to talk about with some authority is, are you noticing any common mistakes in your students' games? Is there like a theme that you find yourself repeating more than any other when you analyze games of your students?
That's a good question. You're making me think. And honestly, at least in recent times, I've been working with a lot more adult players and a lot of like beginner players too, who find me through YouTube and are passionate about chess, but have no tournament experience and just play online. So the answer I might give for this is geared towards the more beginner players. But yeah, like in terms of common themes, I mean, one thing is just identifying the opponent's threat. And this can happen across all different levels, including my level. Like the recent tournament I played, the majority of my stakes involved not seeing my opponent's threat early enough. But especially in the lower levels, I mean, most games are determined by tactics and by blunders. And if you're able to minimize blunders as much as possible, then you'll just win more games. So I think this is one thing to work on. And it's not easy because you have to like shift your perspective. A lot of players perhaps focus too much on what they want to do, what their plans are. But you also have to look from the other side. And I think to become a good player, you have to always be aware of what the opponent wants to do and have the habit that even before you start looking for your own moves, you want to be aware of your opponent's ideas and resources and then adapt your plans and also identify whether or not your opponent's ideas and resources are actual threats and then decide what to do accordingly.
Yeah, as someone who teaches primarily elementary school kids, that's like 70% of what I say, you know, like it's just you cannot harp on it enough. So it's interesting to hear you say, like, even at your level, you feel like, I mean, obviously at a more advanced level of the same problem, you find yourself that deciding a lot of your games. Yeah, I think that one area I know that these things exist, but I feel like there should be more training exercises of just identifying your opponent's threat, because it's so common at what you alluded to about if you're presented a tactic from the winning side's perspective, or if you're playing your game, it's so often players spot tactics from their own perspective, but they would miss it from the opposite perspective. And I know like the steps method has, you know, stop the checkmate and identify the threat. And I know the Susan Polgar sort of more beginner level books have a focus on defensive chess. But overall, I feel like there could be more online training of stopping what your opponent's trying to do.
Sure. Now, you're actually making me remember a book that Susan actually used. It was a book more geared for players on the Webster team. I just did a search here. It's called Recognizing Your Opponent's Resources by Mark Dvoretsky. Maybe it's been recommended before your podcast.
No, I mean, he wrote so many books that, I mean, obviously his name comes up practically every week, but I've never seen that book and I don't believe it's been recommended.
Yeah, I'm looking at like just the preview here, like table of contents. And it seems like, I mean, he's such a renowned author. And I remember going through some exercises in that book, and they were quite difficult. But I think for probably any player above 2000, this could be a useful book to train with, especially if recognizing your opponent's resources is a weakness.
Yeah. So that's good advice for stronger players listening. And we have a chess improvement question from another supporter of the podcast, from Daniel Gell. And he says, hello, Mr. Rosen. He says, I wanted to get your thoughts for someone with limited time to study. Is quality a better use of one's time over quantity? For example, if you have 1 hour to sit down and study a chess book Is it better to go through as much as you can reasonably or to pick up new ideas quicker? Or is it wiser to take the variations slowly and try and absorb them in your brain? For myself personally, I want to get through things at a good pace, though I also want to make sure I'm actually learning the material.
Sure, that's a good question. I mean, the immediate answer that pops up for me would be focus on quality. If you're going to try and cram in like a whole annotated game in a short amount of time, it's going to be harder to retain that information. So I think one element in finding an answer to this question is understanding yourself. And every player is different, and not only in the way they play, but also the way they learn and study. So you have to kind of learn what works for you. If it takes you a bit longer to perhaps remember opening lines or internalize like middle game ideas or patterns, then you definitely want to take your time to absorb the information so it can be retained in your long-term memory. But I think there's other factors to consider when studying. I mean, one thing is kind of active learning versus passive learning. If you're going to pick resources where you're just maybe passively consuming, like watching a video might not be as useful as trying to solve positions over the board and then going back and reading through annotations or looking at solutions. So again, every player is different. And I think one important thing to become better at anything in life is to understand how you learn most effectively and then pursue kind of the habits or kind of training routines that best fit for your learning style.
Yeah, that's good advice. Yeah, and it's funny that you should mention the active versus passive learning thing, because I had the same thought circling back to Bradley Dupree's question when he was asking about finding the appropriate YouTube videos for 1300 to 1500 range players, because I was sort of thinking you might want to be careful with how much YouTube you consume. And he might just be asking about that specific aspect of chess improvement, because certainly it has a place within one's overall chess time, but it can be passive. I know that speaking for myself, if I'm watching like an instructive video, I can sort of zone out and not even realize it for a couple minutes. And if you're sitting there doing tactics or even reading a book, a chess book especially, that isn't as common, at least for me.
Sure. And actually one book that comes to mind that I consumed recently, I actually got the audiobook version of it, which is maybe not directly related to chess content, but definitely mentions chess. It's called The Art of Learning.
Ah, the Josh Waitzkin, yeah.
And it's one of my favorite books, and it talks a lot about just how to approach the learning process. And Josh Waitzkin is just incredible, has an incredible life story, but also articulates like very complex concepts in his book very well, and talks about his road to mastery in chess, but also in martial arts.
Yeah.
And, a lot of what he talks about in the book is really fascinating.
Yeah. For any younger or non-American listeners, Josh Waitzkin is about my age. He's about 42. And in his teenage years, he was like the American chess hope. I mean, he was always in the top two or three for his age. And, you know, that was at a time when the United States was not producing many grandmasters at all, and he was sort of prominent hope to attain that rank. And then, of course, the reason he kind of became orders of magnitude more famous is his father, Fred Waitzkin, wrote the book Searching for Bobby Fischer, which subsequently became a movie. So there's a lot to explore there. But yeah, the book alone is a great read for anyone interested in learning who has not already read it. And I think we just have one more listener question, which we've already touched on some. But I do want to get it in. So Chris Wainscott, who I know you know well, he was one of the people who told me you would be a good guest before the first time you came on. So shout out to Chris for being right about that. He says International Master Rosen. Sorry, he just wants to be formal for once. It seems like over the past few years, you develop a reputation as something of a jack of all trades within the chess world. Player, streamer, coach, photographer, announcer, etc. My question is, how do you balance all those aspects of your career while also setting goals for yourself within those various roles? Follow-up question, could you maybe do a little less well as a coach so that I stop constantly losing games to one of your students?
So. Yeah, that's, I guess there's a few things to try and address there. I guess, first of all, I'll tell him that trying to blame the coach of one of your opponents is not the best way to, to improve your own game.
Yep, got to take responsibility for your results, Chris.
but yeah, no, I've seen a few of Chris's games just through my students, and yeah, there's some things he has to work on, but yeah, hopefully he can have some growth mindset. If he loses, then hopefully he can learn. But yeah, to try and answer the other question, like in terms of balancing so many different things, I think just having structure in place, having routines, and staying organized is very important. And like this question kind of reminded me of like the last maybe month or so, at least in early May, where I took, it was kind of the first 3 weeks of May, I photographed at the Pro Chess League finals. I did commentary for the U.S. Chess Twitch stream in Nashville at the K6 Nationals. And then right after that, I played the St. Louis Norm Congress. And then in between, I was streaming and teaching. So, you know, I was doing all these different things, like a lot of different chess-related jobs in just a very short period of time. And it helps to have a calendar. I use Google Calendar for myself. And I just block out certain times. And I'm working on having like a more designated schedule for streaming. So I know what times of day or times of the week that I'll stream, what times of the week that I'll be giving lessons, and then scheduling around that. And one tool that I'll mention that kind of relates to this, and it's just very practical to keeping your schedule organized, especially for any chess coaches out there. And so the service that we actually use to schedule this this interview, it's called Calendly.com. Yeah. And essentially, I control all of my availability, and I allow people to book like meetings or lessons with me. So it's been very useful, especially to avoid like all the back and forth that you might have with emails in terms of scheduling.
Yeah, I should really get on that. You definitely impressed me. I mean, you set the record for my longest in advance scheduled interview, and you were legit busy. Like we scheduled this like 5 weeks out or something, and you were legit busy. I mean, obviously you had a tournament, so that's sort of like an extenuating circumstance.
Sure,
but still, just the as I said to you in an email, like the level of organization and planning was quite impressive. And you and Elshan Moradiabadi were the two people who impressed me by using Calendly, and I definitely need to get on that for scheduling interviews.
It's interesting. I think I may have introduced Elshan to Calendly. We talked a few months ago, and I remember bringing it up.
Oh, funny.
But yeah, it's one of those things, like it doesn't take so much effort. Like maybe the initial setup, it could take like an hour, and then every month or so I'll sit down for like 20 to 30 minutes and just map out my availability for the month. But yeah, it makes life so much easier, and it streamlines all the kind of the scheduling for people. So it's a nice tool.
Cool. Okay. And getting back to Chris's question, so is there a particular aspect in terms of all your sort of all the hats you wear professionally, is there any one thing you're working on or emphasizing right now?
That's a good question, because things just keep changing. like when I was traveling, I was focusing more on just like the events I was attending, like Pro Chess League finals. It was a lot of networking with people, and then of course taking pictures and editing. And then like the weekend in Nashville, it was just all like chess commentary for the stream. So sometimes it depends on what the timing is. But I mean, right now, I really enjoy the variety, and I think it's important to me that I'm not doing any one thing so much, that I'm keeping the balance and keeping things fresh. I think this is one of the reasons why I really don't want to take like a normal full-time job, like the standard 9-to-5 job, where I'm just maybe focused on one thing throughout the day, because I do enjoy the variety. I like the days where maybe I have a few lessons, I do a stream, I reserve time for myself to go for runs or work out. So yeah, just having a balance, I think, is really important.
Jack of all trades and a master of chess.
Yeah, well thanks.
One topic that I almost let you out of here without addressing, but remember just in time, is you've got to tell the stories of beating Magnus online. I mean, it's such a feather in your cap. You were on the front page of Reddit. So I imagine a lot of people listening might have seen, especially the first one, the one that was linked in Reddit. But why don't you tell our listeners what about those experiences?
Sure. Well, I guess I'll start with like the first time I played him was maybe just less than a year ago. And he plays usually on a monthly basis in the Lee Chess titled arena. And it's a 1 minute tournament, or usually just a bullet tournament designated for title players. And very often he'll play just on his known account. And he actually has several known accounts. But the first time I played him, I didn't know I was playing him. He was playing anonymously. It was actually the very first game in that title arena. And it was some name, I think it was Man with a Van, right, that he was playing under. And it was just a normal bullet game. I was streaming myself, so it's all recorded. And I won, and then I moved on. And then I think like midway through the tournament or after the tournament, it was revealed by like the Lee Chess moderators and also the official stream Chess Network, who was doing commentary for the event, that Man with a Van was Magnus Carlsen. And then I had to go back and rewatch the game with him that I streamed. And it was very nonchalant when I beat him. But yeah, then I posted it to YouTube, at least that clip. And the YouTube video title was, I think, called Unknowingly Beating the World Chess Champion. And then a few months later, it was picked up on Reddit. And it's like, Reddit is like this whole aggregate place. I don't know how many people are out of touch who listen to this podcast with Reddit, but
yeah, it's good for you to explain it.
Yeah, it's where you can upload content, and then any content that reaches the front page of Reddit usually needs to have like tens of thousands of upvotes, and then anything on the front page of Reddit usually gets hundreds of thousands of impressions, if not millions of impressions. So I usually check Reddit, I don't know, daily or every other day. But it was during my time in London in November, I was just scrolling through Reddit just on my app, and I saw my video was posted. And my Reddit feed, it shows posts from the chess subreddit. So I thought that the post was just like in the chess subreddit. But then I looked closer and I saw it had like close to 50,000 upvotes. It was on the front page. And like the viewership on YouTube for that week was pretty insane. Like it was maybe 300,000 new views in a day. And then people were messaging me, like old friends who don't even play chess were messaging me saying that they saw me on Reddit. So it was really interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. I mean, and of course they had to throw a little shade your way. They called it like, what was it? Small time chess streamer beats world champion or something like that. Like,
small-time chess streamer enters anonymous online tournament and beats the world champion.
Right, yeah. I mean, you weren't so small-time, but I guess in comparison to Magnus Carlsen, and certainly thanks to that headline, you're bigger time now. So, but yeah, to me, that made it even funnier.
Well, to be fair, at least for that tournament, it was reported that he was playing from his phone. So okay. Maybe there was some sort of handicap.
Yeah.
But also, even then, I think he finished in like the top three in that tournament.
Yeah.
So.
But also, yeah, I mean, all due respect. And I think you said this in your video yourself. Like, it's not the same thing. If when you don't know you're playing the champion, it's
That's
like
true.
When they don't have that aura, you know, when you don't like, what did they say about Kasparov? Like, you know, you can like feel the brain cells churning from across the board against him. The neurons firing, I should say. When you don't have that feeling, I feel like, obviously, I mean, it's still an incredible accomplishment, but that brings us to the next time, where this time you played Magnus and you knew it was him.
Yeah. And that was in another Lee Chess titled arena. That was actually in a Chess 960 arena where the time control was 2+1. And I feel like that game was probably just more impressive just because I couldn't rely on opening preparation and there was increments. And the game itself was interesting. I should note I also lost to Carlsen one time between the two times I beat him. So my current overall score against him, at least in online bullet, is 2-1.
Uh-oh, you're going to have to avoid him from now on, Eric.
That's true. Just retire.
If you get paired with him, just drop out of the tournament.
Right.
But anyway, continue with your story.
But yeah, the game itself, I mean, it was, I knew I was playing him. It was his doctor and like Durstein account. And I was just trying to be solid. And sometimes like one strategy, at least for playing players that are much, much higher rated than you, is just be solid and wait for them to over push. And somehow the strategy worked where I held my own. And then at some point he made some like dubious sacrifice and I was able to fend off the attack. And then like the very final moment in that game, he played some like very dirty bullet move.
Yeah. I was going to ask you
about
that.
Which maybe you saw.
Yeah. He did one of the, you go ahead.
Yeah. Like he checks my king from far away with his queen. And then across the board, he's also attacking my queen. And sometimes in bullet, especially in like a time scramble situation, it can be easy to miss these types of things. You have to be very aware. But I was very focused that game. I felt like I was in very good form and saw it coming beforehand.
Yeah, so. The long range tactics, the queen on F1, your queen was on F8 and the king was right on like A6 or something. So it's like hard to look in both directions at the same time. Classic hustler's trick.
Exactly. That's why board vision is just so important.
Yeah. And that reminds me, speaking of hustlers, Eric, I just wanted to mention to listeners who might have heard the episode with Jonathan Korbla. I just wanted to, so he's like the game show wizard, and this is another one that goes way back, but mm-hmm. I just wanted to mention that he has a show that's going to be on starting on June 10th on the Game Show Network. So I don't have all the details, but you know, here on Perpetual Chess, we want to keep up with the projects of past guests, and this is an amazing feather in his cap. And you know, we want to see the chess world get out there and you know, put a raise the reputation of chess. You know, he'll be associated as a chess player, despite his also being a trivia wizard. So anyway, I'm going to link to that in the show note, but I did just want to mention it while we're recording.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah,
it's a chess related game show.
No, it's a regular trivia game show.
Ah, I see.
It's one of these like stump the expert type formats, I believe. So John will be the expert, but he's a natural born game show host. So
nice.
I'm excited to see how it goes. Okay, so Eric, is there anything else we need to discuss? Did we get everything?
That's a good question. I prepared like this document beforehand. I think we got through pretty much everything that I had in mind.
Awesome.
I guess I wanted to ask you, because I asked you this last time, like who's your dream podcast guest? And you, last time you said Judit Polgar.
Yeah.
And then you interviewed Judit Polgar.
I think I got two. Since I re-listened to that, I think I might have mentioned Hikaru also. So yeah, two of those were attained. I think I also mentioned Maurice Ashley, who continues to be evasive. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Maurice, but you know, we'll make that happen someday. But I've been updating the list because as I do, I mean, mental list, because as I do more podcasts, I gain more perspective on what my favorite type of guest is. And I've mentioned this before, but I really enjoy the older legends of the chess world. I just feel like they have so many stories that, that, you know, some of them have been written, some of them have been told, some of them have not been told, but just to hear their voices and to hear their stories. So I'm currently reading Timmins Titans upon the recommendation of John Hartman, among others. Have you read that, Eric?
I have not, no.
It's absolutely incredible. I mean, John Hartman had mentioned that he's the rare chess player who's really a writer, and that's really what it feels like. It's like if Gabriel Garcia Marquez wrote a chess book, like a book of his chess memories. I mean, I really can't sing its praises highly enough. So now that I'm reading Timmins Titans, he's basically shot to number one or two on the power rankings. And the person that he's right there with is Boris Spassky.
Okay.
Those are my two absolute dream guests. I mean, and I think I put it back to you last time too, but have you thought of anyone new that I absolutely should be harassing? You mentioned Maurice last time, come to think of it.
Well, I mean, one person who fits kind of your explanation of a dream guest that I don't think has been on the podcast is Yasser Seirawan.
Yeah. And that's primarily my negligence. I don't know if he'd do it or not, but I haven't asked him yet, so I can't blame him.
And he's just loaded with stories. Anytime you talk with him, even casual conversation, it's just another amazing story. So he's very high up there and people that I would like to see interviewed.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, he's up there for sure. And listeners, we'll make some efforts on getting guests like this soon. I think Spassky is going to be a tough one, but but beyond that,
be the right connections.
Yeah, I mean, everyone can only be one degree of separation away in the chess world, so so never say never. All right, well, Eric, this was a lot of fun. It's really good to see you doing so well.
Yeah, thanks so much, Ben. Yeah, it's really cool just listening to the interview 2 years ago and then coming back today. So maybe in a couple more years, there'll be some more to talk about.
Yeah, I'm sure there will be. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how our lives develop and how technology has us talking about some other newfangled platform in 2 years.
For sure, yeah.
But yeah, keep up the good work. So people can follow you on Twitter. They can check out your webpage, subscribe on Twitch. What else should they do?
Yeah, subscribe on Twitch, subscribe on YouTube. I think you mentioned the main things. Website is iamrosen.com. You can Google me and find links to everything.
Yeah. Oh, and last thing, thanks again for you and Kostya Kovutsky doing the report from the World Championship. That did pretty well for as far as these podcasts go. A lot of people listen to that and seem to enjoy it.
Sure. Yeah, it was really cool to report from London. So I guess that makes this my third time on the podcast. So
yeah,
I guess I'm competing with Greg for the most appearances.
Yeah, Greg and Kostya are you guys are all neck and Jan is Jan Gustafsson is he's been on three times too, I guess. So anyway, very heated competition.
Yeah,
as long as Greg doesn't win, I'll be happy.
Fair enough. Yeah.
All right, Eric. Well, thanks again. And yeah, well, good luck and we'll be in touch.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. That includes my producer, Matthew Passy, Geert Vandervelt for supplying the theme music, my wonderful guests, of course. And I also want to thank everyone who helps spread the word about the show, whether it's on Facebook, on Twitter, or on Instagram, telling an actual friend, an actual person about it. Every little bit helps grow the show. But most of all, I want to thank people who support the show financially. Without your financial support, this show would not be possible. I love doing it, but it is a lot of work. So I most of all want to thank Chessable for their support. And I also would like to give extra special thanks to the following people and entities. Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, Andrew Bach, Austin Clough, Benjamin Handelman, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, Dan O'Hanlon, I am Dimitri Schneider, Greg Shahadi, Guven Manet, Jens Green, John Jernigan, Kelly Palmer, Lone Pine Chest, the law offices of Stuart Katz, Sydney Andrews, Thomas Tachenko, and Todd Bryant. And I'd also like to thank the following Patreon partners. You guys are Aaron Wafflart, Ace Vallega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adam Vrancouge, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, BetterChessTraining.com, Bill Moran, Brett Howard Lynn, Brett Zeldo, Brian Mullis, Chad Hilton, Chris Balcom, Chris Flanagan, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Bumgardner, Christopher Chabri, Christopher Wood. I am Christoph Zalicki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Daniel Gell, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Lucas of the U.S. Chess Federation, Daniel Naylor, Daniel Schaefer, Dave Saylor, David Cramley of Chessable.com, Dwayne Edmonds, Ethan Smith, I am Elect, Donnie Ariel, the Fox Valley Chess Club of Aurora, Illinois, Frank Tortoris, MD, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervelt of Chessable.com, Gerard Barda, Giovanni Russo, Greg Natel, Harish Srinivasan, GM Jakob Ogard of Quality Chess Publishing, James Bonastia, Jason Woolham, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, Jen Shahadi, Jerry Wells, JJ Strand, John Thompson, GM Josh Friedel, Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, I am Kostya Kovyutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Laura Boyavsky, Lucio Casada Silva, Martin Knudsen, Matthew Passy, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, The Mysterious Moon Master 9000, The Legend Grows, Mr. Mike Shahadi, Nate Salon, Neil Bruce, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paolo Santana, Peter Lux, Peter Merrifield, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Robert Steiner, Ryan Berg, Scott Daugherty, Scott McKinnon, Steiner Lima, WGM Tatya Vabrahamian, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Vrancouge, William Peterson, Zhao Chang of Chess1000.com, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks, everyone. Catch you guys next week. Podcast Network.